Conestoga Podcast, episode 39 for Tuesday, July 8th, 2008. ...1632 fans have waited a long time for this. Here is my interview with author and editor, Eric Flint. It was recorded at Conestoga 11 / MiniCon 6. A few of the publications mentioned as upcoming in this podcast are now available. I want to welcome you to the Conestoga Podcast. Today I have Eric Flint, who has been a past guest of honor, and he is here for the 1632 MiniCon, which is, of course, named after his 1632 novel, which spawned a phenomenon. And I want to welcome you today.
Thank you.
What I'd like to know is, let's start with the 1632 MiniCon here. I understand this has been going on for a number of years now, and you've been having it around the, I guess what was called the Ring of Fire, is that correct, or the area?
We started it, I believe it was 5 or 6 years ago, and every year we'd hold the, we just called it the MiniCon. Until this year, we'd hold it every year in Fairmont, West Virginia, which is very close to the town of Mannington, that is the model for the town of Granville in the series. And we didn't hold it in Mannington because Mannington doesn't have a motel. So We would stay at a motel, Fairmont, and then the convention would usually last about 3 days, and mostly it would be touring Mannington. After 5 years, the truth is it's a very small town, and you know, the majority of people who come to the convention tend to come back several years, and after a while it just, there's only so many times you can visit Mannington. So we decided we would probably go back there once every few years, but we decided we'd start, keep holding the MiniCon, but we'd tie it in with an existing science fiction convention in some, you know, more centrally located big city in the United States. And Conestoga is the first time we've done it that way, and we're doing Conestoga. And then later this year in September, a smaller number of people who wanted to see the European location of the story were doing a tour. We're actually calling it the Eurocon. It's a tour of part of what used to be East Germany, actually. And we'll be met there, I think it's about 10 of us, and then we'll be met there by a number of Europeans, fans of the series will come in for it.
Okay. Like I said, I want to welcome you and the 1632 MiniCon to Conestoga. And anyway, it's just now starting, so hopefully we'll see how it goes for the rest of the convention. Let's talk a little bit about how it got started, 1632. And I guess, you know, in the past, you know, we obviously started with, you know, Mark Twain's King Arthur, you know, Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court, and then later with L. Sprague de Camp's Lest Darkness Fall, where you have, you know, an individual go back in time. But for 1632, you have a whole town. Were you trying to follow in that tradition of that idea, or is this something that just you decided to go with?
Well, I wanted a time displacement. People argue over whether this is really alternate history or time displacement. It's got elements of both. I don't really care what you call it. But I wanted a time displacement story, and I'd had the idea for a long time. I used to live in that part of West Virginia, and I had the idea that a collective protagonist of a town, a small coal mining town in northern West Virginia, would make a very good collective protagonist. What I couldn't figure out for a long time was where I wanted to set the story historically. And then what happened, just by accident, I was David Drake and I have a contract to do a book, which I still haven't written yet. I'm going to start it next year, but the contract goes back a long ways. But it's actually a near-future science fiction story. And in the outline, David has not developed the background, particularly in any detail, of the aliens who appear in the story.
Uh-huh.
And I got interested, so I told David I wanted to develop that further. If he didn't mind, he didn't. And I try to find some model from history to use when I'm doing something like this, just to get me started. And I hadn't studied the 30 Years' War in many years, so I thought that might make a good model. So I went back and started reading the 30 Years' War about it. And it was right in the middle there. It dawned on me this would be the perfect time and place to take those protagonists I'd had for a long time back in my head and make a story out of them.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing is that time displacement stories have been done a lot. I mean, you can go all the way back, as you said, all the way back to Mark Twain. As far as I know, though, Steve Sterling and I are the first writers who took a collective group of people back, mm-hmm. and we did it almost simultaneously. And there was never any contact between us about it. In fact, the first time I knew about it, I'd seen Steve's book, and it appeared in the stands. I'd seen a cover. My impression had been it was a fantasy novel just because of the cover.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until I told my friend David Drake that the contract I'd signed with Bain Books about the story, and David said, have you read Steve Sterling's Out in the Sea of Time? And my heart kind of froze for a moment. Because this does happen to authors.
Oh, yeah.
More often you might think, where you think, oh, great, and then somebody else comes out with the same idea. And, however, as it turned out, once I realized what his story was, the fascinating thing is we both came up with the same basic premise almost mm-hmm. simultaneously. Just something, things seemed to be in the air at a certain point, God knows why. From there, the stories are very different. But anyway, that's how it came about. It actually was a two or three step process over a period of years. And then I wrote the book in 1999 and came out in 2000.
Did you expect the 1632 to turn into a series?
No. I wrote that first novel. It was intended to be a standalone mm-hmm. novel. And it was quite successful. And a number of people, including my publisher, Jim Bain, urged me to turn into a series, but I resisted for a while because you've got to be careful about this. I work in series usually, and mm-hmm. so I like series, but you've got to be careful about it. It's very, very easy, and I've seen it happen many times, where a good novel turns into a mediocre series, and you can't just do it with any book, and you've got to be able to figure. To this day, I've never written a sequel to my first novel, Mother of Demons, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure I ever will, because you've got to figure out, well, what's the logic of the story beyond there, or else it just turns into, well, then more stuff happened, and that just winds up being kind of the same thing over and over again. And with other series, like the Belisarius series, I knew where it was going from the beginning. I know where the series I'm doing now, set in American history, is going. So it wasn't a problem, but that really, 1632 was kind of finished.
Mm-hmm.
And what I decided I could do was make it work if I did it differently than series have been done in the past. I would open it up to other writers.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't myself try to figure out where it was going. I would just sort of take it one book at a time and just see how this thing might unfold, given the basic premise.
Okay.
And as opposed to, for instance, other series I'm working on where I can very much know where it's going and where it's going to end up, and I may not know in the exact detail how those series mm-hmm. are going to end, but I know basically what the logic of the ending is. This I don't. I mean, it's just we're taking it as we go along.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot like real life.
Yeah, well, that was partly what I wanted to do, was a series of a historical series that captured two things. One, that, just the contingency and mm-hmm. accidental nature of a lot of things. But the other thing I wanted to capture, which I know it aggravates some readers, but life is hard. There's a bias built into fiction that, if you're doing historical material, because in the nature of narrative you have to focus on a few characters,
mm-hmm.
it inevitably gives the illusion or the appearance that the way historical history happened, basically it's always the great man theory of history, whether you intend it to be that way or not. And I happen to particularly detest that mm-hmm. theory of history, but I find in my own writings you wind up kind of doing it just because you're telling a story.
Right.
And what I wanted to do in the 1632 series is cut against that, and there are definitely heroes in the story and people whose role is more prominent than others, but I wanted to have stories, a lot of different people's stories in it, weaving in and out, and just giving people more of the, I guess you can call it the chaos and complexity of how history actually works.
Okay.
And what I didn't know is whether this was going to work commercially or not. So far it has.
Well, that's excellent. Yeah, because in May you've just released 1634, The Baltic War, and in October you're getting ready to release 1634, The Bavarian Crisis.
And then in January we'll be releasing the second of the Ring of Fire anthologies. So, yeah, there'll be, in a space of 7 months, there'll be 30 books, two books coming out.
So the fans have a lot to look forward to then.
Yeah, I hope so.
Well, that's good. I guess what I'd like to transition to, I mean, if you... I'm sure a lot of listeners out there are familiar with the series, and you've already talked extensively about it. I didn't know if you if give people a teaser of what they might expect in a Bavarian Crisis or not, or we could move on to Jim Bayne's universe.
Well, what happens in Bavarian Crisis both runs parallel to the Baltic War, and it serves as a political sequel to it. It's a very different kind of novel. As you would expect, I wrote Baltic War David Weber, who's a certain kind of writer, and Virginia Mars, a very different kind of writer, and and the stories are different. The plane of action, so to speak, of the Bavarian Crisis is, I guess you'd say, smaller. There are actually giant armies in it, but the people observing the battle are mostly refugees trying to hide from the armies rather than being the commanders of them. So you get a different view of things. It's just a very different kind of story, but they intermesh, and the conclusion of Bavarian Crisis resolves one of the main issues left unsettled at the end of the Baltic War.
Okay, excellent.
But it kind of comes at it from a different angle than I think people might have expected.
Well, I think we've pretty well covered the 1632 phenomenon. I'd like to transition to some of your other efforts that you're working on. In particular, I'd like to talk a little bit about Jim Bayne's universe and how that project is going. And how successful has it been so far, the number of subscribers and all that?
It's successful in the sense that we seem to be able to keep going. We had to cut back in some areas, mostly the size of the magazine.
Right.
The first two issues we produced were humongous. They were about 200,000 words long, which is about almost three times the size of a normal magazine in terms of amount of material. And what we discovered, we just didn't know, is that in terms of the number of what income we can expect, the way it projected out, we had to squeeze that down some. We also trimmed down some of the art. Magazine's been able to fund itself since Bayne's initial investment at the start of getting close to 2 years ago. It looks to me like we're going to be able to keep doing that. It's not making any money for Bayne Books. But I've talked to professionals in the magazine industry. What they tell me is that magazines almost invariably lose money for 2 years before they start making any. And actually, by that standard, we're ahead of the game because we haven't lost money.
Yeah.
I mean, well, I shouldn't say that. Bayne put an initial investment in, which they haven't gotten back. But, I mean, there hasn't been it's not like it's been a drain since then. The thing about electronic publishing, you've got a huge advantage over paper publishing, but by the same token, you've got a huge disadvantage. The advantage is obvious. You don't have the enormous cost burden of distribution. I've been told by people very knowledgeable that the gross income from a magazine, at least 60% of it, can be up to 70% of it, will actually go to the distribution network.
Wow.
Whereas an electronic magazine like ours, the distribution cost isn't more than, oh, I don't know, maybe 10%, and actually that drops as you get bigger because it tends to be fixed. It's not per unit.
Yeah.
It's a certain amount we pay to maintain the website, that kind of thing. So on the one hand, you have that tremendous advantage, and it really is because that distribution cost of paper magazine is a percentage cost, so it never drops no matter how much money you make. Mm-hmm. You're still paying the same amount. If our electronic magazine had the same circulation as any one of the four big print science fiction magazines, which is between around 15,000 and 40,000, we'd be rolling in dough because we don't have the same costs they do.
Yeah.
The disadvantage, though, is that the one thing about paper publishing, whether it's book or magazine, is every single book or magazine you publish amounts to a billboard.
Right.
You're visible out there in bookstores. If you publish electronically, you're invisible. I mean, nobody sees you.
Mm-hmm.
They can find you in a website, but there are God only knows how many by now. Does anyone know how many websites exist? I mean,
it must
be in the millions.
In the millions and millions. I mean,
yeah. And so, you know, it's just you vanish. So figuring out how to promote the magazine, it's difficult. That's one problem. The second problem is that the electronic market is just a very small market so far. And in my opinion, as long as most publishers persist in the digital rights management way of publishing electronically, it's going to stay small. Because customers hate it. But whether we don't publish that way, but it, we're still part of that market, so it's just not very big. So we are now well into the second year of publication, which we'll certainly be able to finish. And we're I have to talk to our publisher, Tony Weisskopf's going to be here. I'm almost sure we're going to continue the third year and just see how it keeps going. So I can't say it has proven to be a phenomenal success because we don't know yet, but it isn't going under either.
Well, that's excellent. I certainly wish you further success with that, and hopefully it will continue to grow. Just my comment on electronic publishing, digital rights management, you know, the way that publishers want to use it basically sucks. It's actually rights management for the publisher, not for the consumer. But I think what's going to really take off is once basically they have portable electronic readers that you can take into the bathroom and not get wet.
Well, I actually think myself the key is a little different than that. There are two fundamental ways you can bind information that the human race has ever discovered. One of them is a scroll, the other is a codex. And all computer screens so far are scrolls.
Right.
And scrolls are weird because it's a strange thing. I know this, that it's true of me as a writer, and I've asked other writers. Every single writer I know will do a certain amount of line editing on a screen.
Right.
But when a point comes in a book, and it always does, or you want to get a sense of how the book as a whole does, you print a hard copy and read it.
Right.
And I think there's something – I thought maybe this is my own mysticism until I read MIT did a study of their students. Now, remember, these are their students today who are supposedly the computer generation. It's not some
right.
fogey like me. You know, these are the kids who grew up with them.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found was that if the same students read exactly the same material in a book than they read electronically on a screen, their comprehension and retention was 30% better. And they think the reason is that there's something about the way the human brain is hardwired, that if you can hold a codex-bound piece of information, you can somehow sense the whole thing, whereas when you're looking at a screen, which is a scroll, it just seems to do something different to your brain. So
okay.
I personally think the real test for whether electronic reading will ever replace paper reading in a big way, and the technology exists, it's just they haven't made it cheap enough yet, but is when they actually produce a book that looks like a book. It's got the, you know, the pages you flip and you just load it.
Yeah, there's in the lab, there's things like electronic paper.
And all that kind of stuff. And I think the technology is doable. Now, I will say, having said all that, that I think that the projections and predictions that electronic reading are going to replace paper reading are vastly over, what's the word I want?
Overrated.
Here's a very simple reality. Paper printing is not an obsolete industry. It's a very efficient way of binding information, and it has a lot of real advantages, the most important which is it's been time-tested and proven for centuries. Nobody has yet to demonstrate they can produce a piece of software that people are still going to be using in 50 years.
Right.
I've got paperbacks at home that are still good 50 years later. I mean,
they're
getting kind of old and beat up, but I can still read them. I can't read any software I had 10 years ago. And I've said that some people say, oh, it's not hard. You do this, do that, do this, do that, do that, and translate. I says, most people are not geeks.
This is so true.
They're not. And maybe you can do it. It's part of, again, the same argument people talking about. Oh, it's real easy to pirate a book. You do this, 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 and this, and it's easy. And I say, I would not know how to pirate one of my own books. And therefore, I know that if somebody offers to sell me a legitimate copy for $2 or $3, I'm just going to do that rather than worrying about where I'm going to go off to get a pirated copy. And it's the same way electronic reading. I mean, paper books, they work just fine for most purposes. And there are some purposes. I know submariners who love electronic reading because,
right.
you know, they go on a submarine and the only place they got to put a book is under their mattress, and an electronic book is great. I know people like to actually, what we're discovering at Bain is that given their preferences, people read electronically will typically prefer to have the same book in both formats, paper and electronically, because they'll read it by default paper when they can. But if they get on a subway to go to work, they'll take the same book with them on their PDA. And one lady told me, I didn't even thought of that. She said, oh, I love my PDA because I can be at a boring staff meeting and reading a book and nobody knows what I'm doing because it looks like I'm, you know, doing something with a PDA.
Right.
So I think what's going to happen is what you're really going to see. It's like, you know, automatic transmissions have never displaced manual transmissions. They just carve up a big chunk of market. I think probably even better analogy is food processors. A lot of people have home food processors.
Right.
I don't know anybody who's gotten rid of their kitchen knives. I know my mother got me a food processor. I used it once. And I said, Mom, I don't use it after that. And she said, why not? Doesn't it work? I said, it works great. Did a wonderful job of cutting up the carrots, bloody, bloody, blah. And then it took me 15 minutes to clean it. I can clean a knife in 5 seconds. And I don't do enough large-scale cooking that it's worth it to me. Now, if I had a bigger family or kids are still at home, I could see keeping the food processor. I think that's what you're going to find. I think you're going to find increasingly. I don't think paper books are going to go out anytime soon.
No.
I mean, and by anytime soon, I mean for 100 years. I think you will see a lot of electronic reading and more of it. But I think what you're going to see is the two combined rather than one or the other. That's what I'm predicting here.
Perhaps something along the lines of a blank book, like you would have for a journal, that you'd snap a cover onto that would actually have the entire book encoded to it to go ahead and fill up the electronic paper with the entire text.
Yeah, you could do that.
Yeah. We had just had a comment from the audience about a blank book that you could snap a cover on and to be able to and read it from there.
Yeah, no, I think that's what will happen. They'll sell it and you just keep the same. There's a lot of other things, too. You know, people like books for home decoration. And, you know, another electronic gadget is not going to replace bookcases. I just think there are all kinds of reasons books are going to be around for a long time. I think you will see more electronic reading because there are some advantages to it, not just from the side of readers, but also from the side of publishers and distributors.
Well, I think any technology, a lot of times the technology doesn't necessarily reach its full potential peak until it's already been supplanted. Technology and weapons and blades and swords and stuff like that really didn't reach their peak until long after firearms were introduced.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
And so I have a feeling that, the printed word, I think, has a long future ahead of it. And hopefully they'll find more sustainable materials to print it on besides wood pulp.
Yeah, you know, even then, I mean, you know, bookbinding isn't the problem. There are rainforests being cut down destroyed, but it's not in order to, you know, for bookbinding or books.
Yeah.
I mean, they're being cut down just to clear them out of the way so they can get something more profitable immediately out of it. Yeah. Actually, the biggest problem environmentally with paper producing, is actually not the threat to trees. Mm-hmm. It's that it produces a lot of pretty corrosive and toxic chemicals in the course of it. That's really the bigger problem. I mean, trees are doing fine.
Actually,
the United States, I'm a student of American history.
Mm-hmm.
The United States is more heavily forested today. You can see forests of New England. You can see New England had almost no trees on it 200 years ago. They'd stripped them all bare. The main thing was when they didn't have to keep using wood for fuel.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden, the trees start coming back.
Well, Oklahoma's got a lot more trees now since the Dust Bowl days. So.
Oh, wow. I grew up in Southern California.
Yeah.
And Southern California is kind of wild because practically any tree you see there is not native. It was a desert.
Yeah. There's a lot of eucalyptus.
Eucalyptus, yeah.
Yeah. And they like to burst into flames.
Yeah.
So, okay. Let's see. Where can we go now? I can take this a number of directions. You do a lot of collaborations. I know that you're working on a sequel to Course of Empire with Katie Wentworth.
Mm-hmm.
I asked her the other day where it's at. She said, well, we're working on it, but we don't have any timetable. So,
no, where it's at is she was being diplomatic and polite. Where it's at is I owe her the next big chunk of the outline.
She
can, you know, she's gotten the first big chunk of it written, first draft, and then Katie will write the first draft. I'll do the same with Course of Empire. Mm-hmm. She'll write the first draft, then she'll pass it to me, and I'll write the second draft. And then from there, we'll kick it back and forth till we got a draft ready. But I'm supposed to outline the plot, and I haven't gotten her the next chunk of it because I got jammed up with a different deadline, plus I traveled a lot in the last 2 months.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about just the art of collaboration. I guess, is each collaboration different with different authors?
Yeah. Yeah, they're all different. I do want to make one prefatory comment, though, because I think most people have a skewed view historically of what storytelling's like as an art. Storytelling is probably the oldest art form we have. except for the last few hundred years, it has been, throughout the evolution of the human race, an overwhelmingly collaborative enterprise.
Okay.
I once said that to somebody, and they said to me, that can't be true. Name any really important collaborative literary works. I said, well, start with the Bible. Beowulf, the Homeric epics, they're named after a guy named Homer, but nobody really thinks there was one guy who sat down and came up with those stories. They're obviously part of legendary cycles. Same is true with all the medieval legendary cycles. The fact is, what happened was the advent of printing and the fact that writers could make a living by selling enough printed copies of a work, mm-hmm. and the fact that technologically it's very hard to work with somebody when you're writing that way, it is.
Okay.
Meant that all of a sudden writing started getting very individual. And writing is just a form of storytelling.
Right.
And what's happened in the last 15, 20 years is the development of computers has actually removed those obstacles. It's just as easy to do. I can remember when I started writing, not only did you not have computers, you didn't have Xerox mm-hmm. machines. The only way you could make a copy of something was you had to make a carbon copy while you made it, or you had to take it to a Photoshop and have it photocopied, which cost an arm and a leg.
Yeah. Well, with the advent of podcasting, although audio on the internet has been around for a long time, its storytelling is starting to come full circle because now you're having people read their works.
So I think what's happening is there's just really a shift back in the direction that it has been most of the human race existence, which is the storytellers tend to be rather convivial and swap stories back and forth. So mm-hmm. I don't think it's really that odd. However, having said that, I do a lot of collaborative writing for a number of reasons. One is I happen to be good at it. And it is a skill, and not all writers are. I know mm-hmm. writers who just, they can't. I mean, and they shouldn't, because they're just, you know, they just, it's very individual the way they think of and develop a story. Me, it's not. Secondly, the one thing I don't like about being a professional writer, I like everything else about it. I love not having a boss. I don't have a time card. It's a great job. With one exception, mm-hmm. is that basically your job consists of going in a room somewhere and talking to yourself for hours every day. It's actually the reason I come to science fiction conventions. I don't do it to promote. Some authors seem to think it helps promote their works, and it's true that's the side effect of it. But if you figure it out cold-bloodedly, mathematically, how much extra sales you're going to boost of your work by coming to convention, and then match against it the cost, even if the convention pays the whole way, you're still losing writing time, and it's a completely losing proposition. I do it just because I think it's good for me to get out of house every 2 months and go talk to people. I didn't invent them. I can't predict how they're going to react, uh-huh. you know, and so forth. And that's the one thing I don't like about writing, is it's very solitary existence. And collaborative writing breaks that down a lot. It's very social, convivial. It's a lot of fun. I enjoy it.
Yeah.
And the final thing is that you can produce stories in collaboration that you would find it very difficult, if not impossible, to tell on your own. Mm-hmm. For instance, to give just one obvious example, the story I did with Reich Spoor, the novel came out last year, Boundary. I'd had that story plotted in my head for 15 years. And the problem was the amount of research I would have had to do a decent job of it was so daunting that I just always pushed it aside. And mm-hmm. then I ran across Reich. We got to know each other. Once I realized his technical background, I realized he already had, if I shifted the plot a little bit, mm-hmm. he already had the set of skills that he could tell that side of the story. We could just get on with it. So that's why we did it.
Well, I appreciate the insight on the collaborative effort, because I know there's a lot of people out there that they are learning to write and eventually want to break into the field, and collaboration is obviously one of the methods for doing that. I think I want to shift gears a little bit and kind of go back to Jim Bayne. And I know that you are going to be doing a toast to Jim Bayne later on. If there's anything that you would like to say about Jim Bayne here on the podcast, you're more than welcome to take the mic here.
Well, there's a lot I can say about Jim. He was one of the most important publishers in science fiction over the last 20 years. He's the person who got my career started. He was my first publisher, and to this day, Bayne Books has published not everything, but almost everything I've written. In the editorial I wrote for the magazine after Jim died, the one thing he did that makes him unique is that he's the only commercial publisher, not just science fiction,
publisher, commercial publisher that I know of any size in the United States, who from the beginning of the digital era refused to go along with digital rights management. And in practice, Jim, experimenting, trying out different ways of selling electronic publications, I think history will record, as they say, when looking back on it, was probably the single most important thing in what I certainly hope and do believe will be the final defeat of this really quite dangerous approach to electronic publishing, which is not just annoying to the reader, but it's politically dangerous. If you think of all the implications involved in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, it's a tremendous blow at traditional copyright. It's a tremendous infringement on our traditional approach to freedom of speech. It's really much worse than just simply a bad way to sell books. It's dangerous. And I think Jim was the only publisher who felt that strong about it and had a clear alternative to it. And that's what makes the key difference, because a publisher is in a position to demonstrate that you can do it some other way, which an author can, no one else can, but a publisher can, and he did. And it's a fact, which is now within science fiction pretty much accepted, that Bain is easily the leader and most successful science fiction publisher electronically. Pays its authors the best royalties, has the best sales per unit, I mean per book. And that's important because science fiction plays a disproportionate role in electronic publishing. I mean, it's a much bigger chunk of electronic publishing as a whole because of the nature of the audience. Other than that, he's a friend of mine and fascinating guy.
Well, I certainly hope that you can continue the tradition that he started.
No, that's pretty well set in stone.
I mean,
it's you know, yeah, no, that's there's no way Bain's going to veer from that. It's not just simply that the new publisher, Toni Weisskopf, comes out of Bain. I mean, she was Bain's chief executive editor for years, and but the authors. Bain has, you know, new authors coming and so forth, but Bain, like most publishers, has a stable core of good-selling authors, and all of them are completely convinced of the way Bain does it. That's how things tend to change. I mean, actually, the term vested interest is usually used in a negative way, you know?
Yes,
but
I know.
There is such a thing as a good vested interest, and if you have people develop a vested interest in something that's good, it makes it hard to make that go away, too. So I think I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Eric. Another two cents on the copyright issue. I certainly hope that we can repeal some of these unconsumer-friendly laws, especially the ones that have basically have locked up copyright for essentially forever.
Those are outrageous. Life plus 70 is just it's grotesque. It has nothing to do with defending. Authors need to make a living, obviously, and they're going to have to pay them somewhere or another, and the only alternative to copyright is some kind of patronage, and patronage has its own set of problems. So I think, you know, I don't think any rational person out there denies or doesn't really understand you need copyright, and you need some period of time where authors are given what amounts to monopoly in their work so they make a living off it. That's fine. But that's its only purpose. That's its only legitimate purpose. And no author in the history of the universe has ever written a book because they say to themselves, if I write this book and it sells well, my great-great-grandchildren, whom I don't know, might not have to work for a living. I mean, this has never all motivated a single author in the history of the world. So why do we need Life Plus 70?
Yeah. We're almost out of time here, but I think that one of the biggest dangers to this Life Plus 70 or 90 years for corporate copyrights is orphan works.
Yeah, that's true.
I know, especially like an author like R.A. Lafferty, who has, you know, his works are kind of languishing, and although he does have heirs, there's a lot of them, but there are other authors, they may not have heirs, and nobody knows who published them, and there are people that want to reprint them, and, you know.
No, it's horrible. I do, as an editor, I do a lot of reissues, and here's the reality. Very, very often, you don't know who the heirs are. the heirs don't know they're the heirs.
Right.
You got to understand something. The value of most published works is very small.
Right.
It's not the money, it's an issue. I mean, all you're doing is trying to track down an heir so you can give them $100, $150 the right to reissue a story, and that's what publishers do. It's not like, you know, it's peanuts, really. The amount of time, effort, and money it takes to track them down, especially when they may not even know they're the heirs, because it's like, well, who got great aunt silverware? Well, who knows, you know, and who cares? I mean, people don't keep track of this stuff.
It's that that makes it so prohibitive. That what typically happens with long copyright terms, it doesn't protect writing, it destroys it. Because what happens is it just makes it such a headache to find out who has the rights that publishers just don't publish it until it falls in the public domain. But by that point nowadays, so much time has gone by that anybody who might have remembered that author is long dead. That's what happens in the real world. And, yeah, I hate it. The only people that benefits is giant corporations, and it's just part of an intellectual land grab of trying to lock up as much as they can for as long as they can, because they have giant staffs of lawyers who will keep track of everything they own and sue you if you infringe on it, and so on and so forth. But that's the only people that's benefiting.
Okay. Well, let's hopefully that will change, but it's going to be a struggle to restore our rights. So, anyway, well, Eric, I want to thank you very much for joining us on the Conestoga podcast.
Sure.